This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Stanley Bing is a business humor writer. He's written several books, including this year's What Would Machiavelli Do?, a sort of how-to guide for business executives who want to find and release their inner tyrants. For 5 years, he's written a monthly column in Fortune magazine. Before that, he wrote for Esquire. His Fortune columns end with the phrase, "By day, Stanley Bing is a real executive at a real Fortune 500 company he'd rather not name." But the secret has leaked in recent years. The company is CBS, and Stanley Bing's real name is Gil Schwartz, the executive vice president of communications for CBS Television. It does seem, when you look over this, what is now more than a 15-year body of work in terms of the columns, that you did go from like a sort of Dilbert mentality, where you were on that level, to you were the Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. I mean, you became the guy that most... Your problems were not about the guy that you worked for so much as the people who worked for you, and then the big guy that you had to report to, and all the other people that were that had made it to your level.
I see myself more like Smithers, actually.
But, that's an awful thing to say for public consumption.
I don't think I'm actually ever going to make it to the kind of Mr. Burns level, but I'm happy not to be working in, you know, in Homer Simpson's chair. I've always enjoyed Dilbert. I thought Dilbert was very focused and very true about, you know, organizational life. A few years ago, a guy who was the head of human resources called me up and he said to me, do you read Dilbert? And I said, yeah, I do. And he said, you know, this character, Catbert, the evil human resources vice president, I think it's a really unfair characterization, don't you? And the guy really was pretty much Catbert, so it was amusing and kind of illustrated a point that I've felt over the years, which is that very often you will describe someone and they will read it and they'll find it amusing because they think you're writing about someone else. So that's sort of what's happened over the years.
That's very funny. It reminds me of actually one of my favorite columns of yours, which is about marketing consultants, business consultants, where you did a toss-away line insulting them, just warning young people not to become them. And then when you got an outcry, you did a longer column that said some of the reasons why. And I want to read it, and then I want to ask you if it's really cathartic for Gil Schwartz, who can't say these things necessarily to marketing consultants who come into CBS where you work now, to be able to say it in print. So I'm going to read your words here from a column from earlier this year in Fortune magazine. "The boss likes you far too much. You're an institutionalized suck-up. You're there to make him look good when he shouldn't. Does he listen to the guys who are in the trenches every day? No, he does not. Instead, here comes you. You hold meetings. You're looking into things. If anybody asks Mr. Beanbag what he's doing about slow growth in sales, he can say, oh, I've hired the McWiener Group to look into that. They'll be giving me a report real soon, and if there's any resistance in implementing those goals, well, you can bet that blah, blah, blah. Boy, doesn't he look dynamic. And what if it is, in fact, Mr. Beanbag who is the problem? Do you tell him that? Well, do you?" I loved that.
Thank you. Thanks.
But, I mean... You are now, I mean, we haven't talked too much, and I want to spend a little bit of the interview talking about exactly the sort of decisions and jobs and roles and everything that you have in CBS at that high level. But CBS at that high level is not without its cadres of consultants.
Actually, we don't have that many. You know, I came up the ranks when it was Westinghouse, and also it was the 80s and 90s, and... there was a lot of McKinsey-type stuff around, and there were always these kind of people that were in the system because there were problems that they didn't want to fix by hiring people that knew anything about stuff. And I developed an aversion towards these expensive solutions. I mean, you know, you go and you want to either yourself get a raise or give somebody a raise of more than 3%, and you're told, no, that's out of the guideline. And then you see a bill somewhere that says that a consultant has been paid to put, like, you know, paper... sheets up on a wall and write on them and has been paid, you know, six figures, and you start to feel resentful. The consultant thing was a goad, you know. I had written, you're right, a sentence in something saying, it was basically a graduation speech saying, and by the way, don't be a consultant. And I'd gotten, you know, hundreds of emails from people, not so much angry as curious, like, why? Why do you say that? So then I wrote this piece in which I just basically, you know, without any subtlety about it, took the gloves off and, and kind of just, you know, ragged at consultants for a while, which I've always wanted to do. And I got, again, you know, just a ton of email. I would say 98% of it very positive, and most of it from consultants saying, you're right. I don't know what I'm doing. I come in, I don't have time to work right. Here are the problems with my business. I'd like to get a real job. How does a person go inside a corporation? It was fascinating. I think it's it may be that, except for very specific uses, the generic 27-year-old consultant who graduated from Harvard and went to McKinsey and makes a ton of money and, you know, wears blue pinstripe suits, and that model may be fading, in at least in the part of the business that I'm in. They may be selling it somewhere in the Midwest, but I don't see a lot of them around anymore.
Now that people at CBS are sort of aware of your other life, are they comforted by your sense of humor, or are they afraid of it?
Well, no, I think I've always been sort of like, you know, the combination of class clown and the fool and Lear. I mean, you know, the job for me has always been to kind of say stupid things and, you know, be funny and, you know, not be too dangerous about it. But I've never really had to muzzle myself that much. I came out as Stanley Bing in the middle 90s because I had a book that was out called Crazy Bosses, and I wanted to go on talk shows and talk about the book. I mean, it had taken me 4 or 5 years to write the book, and I was, you know, I thought it was pretty stupid to show up on, like, you know, Good Morning America with a blue dot in front of my face. So I went and told my boss, who has since said that he had two reactions. One was to congratulate me, and the other was to throttle me. So, and since then, you know, I've felt that when Gil Schwartz says something stupid and inadequate, it's possible that in people's minds they go, that can't be that stupid, because he's also Stanley Bing, so he must be smarter than he looks, you know. So I think it's helped me in the long run.
But, I mean, here you are. I mean, really, you are responsible for the CBS corporate image. I mean, your job is at the top.
I'm one of the people responsible for that.
Okay, yeah. But you're sort of responsible for all the other people who are responsible for it, right?
Mm, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here you are. I mean, that is as big a sort of a situation that you can get in that field. And yet you're also Stanley Bing, who has written endlessly about how much he hates meetings. And when he's in meetings, he stretches out his feet and sort of pretends that he's still on a lounge chair in the Bahamas or somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and has meeting narcolepsy. I have a big problem with meeting narcolepsy.
Right, and has all these tricks to try to stay awake and pretend to be interested when all he's doing is making fun of the other people in the room. How do you, as Gil, maintain seriousness in a room when, if I were in that room with you, I would be worried that you had all of the same opinions that Stanley does?
David, I don't know. No, it's true that it is two parts of my personality. I mean, I believe that everybody sitting in a meeting that extends more than an hour is in horrible torment. I'm speaking for everybody in the room there, and that includes the CEO of the company. If he's sitting in the room and he's forced to listen to drivel for more than a certain amount of time, he's sitting there and thinking, oh, man, I wish I were at the beach. I wish I were having my hair cut. I mean, God, I have 87 things to do. Nobody likes long meetings. And, you know, I don't think I ever say anything about the organizations that anybody in his right mind would disagree with. I mean, I get a lot of letters and I talk to a lot of people. And nobody says to me, what do you mean meetings are boring? I don't understand. Meetings are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Most people really feel that, you know, out of an eight-hour day, at least 20% of their day is wasted by nitwits bothering them about stuff they have no desire to deal with. And, you know, when you're, you know, I don't, not everybody agrees with me about everything, but, for example, you know, I'm annoyed by Palm Pilots. I mean, I see people, instead of talking to you, like, you know, with their nose in a Palm Pilot, poking at it with a little stick, you know, and I'm thinking, this is just some kind of a wacky fad. These people, you know, are trying to create the illusion of controlling an uncontrollable universe. And, you know, I'm just annoyed and kind of intellectually and emotionally engaged by a real lot of stuff that everybody, you, me, everybody goes through. And I think that for the most part, if I feel something deeply, if I feel, you know, whether I'm enthusiastic about something or excited or annoyed, that there's a fair chance that if I describe it well, that a lot of people are going to feel the way I do. And that's really where Bing is coming from. You know, when I'm sitting in that meeting, if I'm falling asleep, I know I'm not the only one. And I look around the table and I see guys.
At least you hope that.
I see guys poking themselves with you know, pens and stuff and you know, getting up to get a fourth muffin with great seriousness. And I know they're trying to keep from falling asleep, you know. You know, I think in a way Bing has always been a chance for me to try to be and to be the voice of my peers, whether the peer is making more or less money, but people who work for a living should recognize Stanley Bing's world.
Gil Schwartz, otherwise known as Stanley Bing, columnist for Fortune magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Gil Schwartz, Executive Vice President of Communications for CBS. He writes a column for Fortune magazine under the name Stanley Bing. Well, as Stanley Bing, you liken it to hardball when you do corporate stuff at that level. So let me ask Gil Schwartz about some of the hardball games that you've played in the last couple of years. The fortunes of CBS basically turned around with Survivor, and being the head of publicity for Survivor somewhere along the line changed from getting out information about the show to keeping a lid on information about the show, and at times even spreading or encouraging or not squelching disinformation about the show. What was that like, especially in the weeks leading up to the big finale?
Well, I know I should preface any comments about this, you know, the everyday world of the work is that I have, you know, unbelievably great people that work at CBS that work with me. You know, I don't want people to have this impression of me sitting and kind of like pulling strings all over the place. I have a fantastic department of people, and they're very involved in all of the decisions to the point where, you know, I have to ask them what's going on a lot of the time. So, you know, that's sort of thing one. But, you know, the Survivor thing was and remains an enormous phenomenon. I mean, it's like being part of Beatlemania. It's a great pleasure. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to say much more about it than that, because there's a little regulator inside me that is even more secretive about Survivor than it is about my dual identity.
You know, we can get past that. We can get.
No, the thing is, I spent several months saying nothing about it at all.
I mean, it. I knew, you're even using it as a pronoun.
I every word I'm saying right now is going through a synthesizer to make sure I'm not saying the wrong thing. We are really clamped down tight about it. So I think we're very mindful of security as an issue.
But and, you knew the secret. You had to know the secret. I mean, we're talking about the secret of Survivor 1, okay?
Yes, the secret of Survivor 1.
All right.
That's the Hardy Boys book, The Secret of Survivor 1.
You knew that Richard had won long before those programs were broadcast. How did you ever keep that secret?
I can't even tell you that, except that we just were very careful.
Was it hard for you personally?
To this moment where you just said to me that you know who won, I have this psychotic constriction of my you know, my stomach, where I'm
good
wondering
choice.
whether you've you know, whether we've just blown some secret wide open. It's been so programmed into me not to say anything about this subject that right now I'm sweating bullets here.
Okay, so I don't mean to make you uncomfortable.
Let me say it's the most pleasant problem that any of us have ever had. It's total fun.
Was it in planning now? What we do know about Survivor 2, which I'm free to talk about, and I think you are too, is that CBS has chosen to launch it after the Super Bowl.
Yes, we can say that.
Okay, and that I think that the eventual broadcast of it on a weekly basis past that at this point has been narrowed down to Thursday. As one of the possible days, Wednesday, where it was last year, is one of the possible days. Is that fair, or does that make your stomach nervous?
Both.
Okay. All right. I recognize that is as close as I'm going to get.
We had a call last week where Leslie basically indicated that the possibility of the show being on sometime in midweek was significant. That was a significant possibility. He narrowed it down to a couple of days or three, and those were among those that he talked about.
Painful as this is, I do have one more Survivor question, and this is: how did people, both reporters who wanted to get the answer and just everyday friends or family that may have known or suspected or hoped that you knew it, how did they try to get the name out of you?
Oh, well, you know, the problem was never with reporters, because reporters after a while knew that we just weren't going to talk about it. And after a while, you know, even the best reporter will just move on. It was family members and friends who would say things like, "So you know, right?" And I'd say, "No, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I might, I don't know." And they go, "Well, so who was it? It was Rudy, right?" And I go, "Maybe. Could have been Rudy. That's a pretty good guess." "No," my daughter would say, Is it Rudy?" And I'd say, "Well, no, I'm not going to tell you, you know." And and they wouldn't stop, you know. It would be like every day over breakfast, "So what are you going to do at school today?" "Nothing much." "So it's Jervis, right?" And, you know, so it was pretty relentless. And and, you know, the problem for me, as for anybody who has a secret, is there's a part of the human mind that's always, for some reason, wants to blurt. And anybody who's tried to keep a secret, like a surprise party, for instance, from their nearest and dearest, knows that there's a part of you that wants to just blurt it out. And so that's why, to this day, I don't even say the names of the survivors in Survivor 1 without, you know, kind of going through the central computer system and finding out if I need to shut down.
So as we speak, where are we in Survivor 2? I mean, a lot of them are off the island already. I'm not asking you whom, but I mean in the process. Aren't we about halfway through that?
Of what?
Of Survivor 2. I don't know how far in advance the filming has gone on that, frankly.
Which?
The Survivor 2. Now, there is a show called Survivor 2. You can't deny the existence of it. It's premiering.
Yes. After the Super Bowl.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So,
and it's in the Australian Outback.
It's in the Australian Outback, and it is taped ahead of time, and it is...
At this point, we just go off and kind of have a drink somewhere.
Okay.
We're done.
Okay.
That's basically all that anyone knows. Where it is, what its name is, and when it's premiering.
Okay. So you're good at secrets.
Yeah, I'm good at secrets. I mean, I kept the secret of my pseudonym for 10 years and would only basically let it out when it was to my benefit to do so, although I was busted a couple times by some friends. I was not careful enough in some columns and mentioned some things that got me caught. But for a while there, it was pretty entertaining. I mean, people in my corporation used to circulate me my own column. They would send me my column with a little note on it that says, "Think you'll find this amusing."
That's funny.
And I would send it back to them going, "You're right, it's hilarious." Oh. You know.
Well, thanks so much, Gil. I know that part of this was sort of tricky with the two different people and some of the tricky survivor issues and survival issues, but thanks a lot for talking to us.
It's my pleasure, really. It was a lot of fun.
Gil Schwartz. He's otherwise known as Stanley Bing, columnist for Fortune magazine.